Second Committee on Rules. We're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 10, and I think everyone's fairly familiar with the contents of the bill. It looks like we have a couple folks signed up to testify. Would Wayne Baum and Josh Reese come on forward, please? Did I get your names right?
Yes, correct.
Okay. The joys of phonetics. Good morning and welcome.
Morning.
Folks are coming in. It's just been a crazy day, so sorry to keep you guys waiting.
No problem.
Go ahead.
You want us to begin?
Sure. You need to state your name for the record and give us your thoughts on Senate Bill 10.
Chair Brown, members of the committee. My name is Wayne Baum, resident of Salem. Is this on?
Yep.
I was asked to give testimony by the Money in Politics Research Action Project, and I welcome the opportunity to give you a few reasons why I support SB 10. A few days ago, I heard a member of the House suggest that there really wasn't a serious problem with freshly unemployed legislators immediately coming back in the door as paid lobbyists. She argued that since there was little evidence of impropriety and corruption, the issue was merely one of public perception. But is that perception unwarranted? When the public is regularly treated to news stories about lavish trips to Hawaii, expensive meals, and golf excursions funded by lobbyists, can we fault the public for just a little, being a little bit suspicious of these relationships? When the Oregon Government Standards and Practices Commission, our independent government watchdog agency, has been unable to adequately carry out its mandate due to insufficient funding and staffing by the legislature in recent years, can we really blame the public for being somewhat suspicious of the actions and motives of our elected officials? I applaud Senator Courtney, Chair Brown, and all of you who support this bill. It is a good first step in restoring public confidence in government.
Okay.
By guaranteeing full and independent funding for the Oregon Government Standards and Practices Commission, the public is assured of an adequate level of oversight and accountability. Legislators can only make good decisions when they hear all sides of an argument. Money should not be a factor. The strict limitations on gifts and gratuities that this bill provides for will help to level the playing field of among all competing interests. Online quarterly filing of expenditure statements by lobbyists will greatly assist public interest groups in monitoring activity and ensuring that the legislative process proceeds without undue influence by special interests. I believe the public's perception of SB 10 is that it is a good bill, long overdue, a first step to better government, and I ask that you support it in its entirety. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Reese.
Yes. My name is Josh Reese. I live in Salem, and I'd like to thank the committee for the opportunity to speak to you. I was asked to give testimony by the Money in Politics Action Group. But for many, many years, I have been very concerned about the increasing amounts of money that is being used in the political process, and I think it's tend to undermine the political fairness of the system. Actually, I only have a little bit of political experience myself. I ran for in the Republican primary in 1984 against Denny Smith in the 5th Congressional District. If I were to tell you how much I spent on my campaign, mostly out of my own funds, you would probably fall off your chairs laughing. but I did get, as an ordinary citizen, 40% of the vote. Now, actually, I got 31% of the vote, but every time I tell the story, I give myself another 20%. All right.
In 2 years, I'm going to have one a natural politician.
But recent news and this state of congressional scandals of bribes and money laundering and all kinds of other things at the national and even the state level now, I think has really undermined ordinary citizens' confidence in the fairness of the political process. Specifically, I want to support two elements of the Senate Bill 10. We need to set low limits on the value of gifts lobbyists can give to legislatures and tighten the reporting standards further. This legislature must ensure that Oregon citizens, their elected officials, maintain the highest ethical standards. For those that don't, the Government Standards and Practice Commission must receive more funding from different sources for long-term stability. The current oversight resources are, in my opinion, inadequate. As a retired Marine Lieutenant Colonel, responsibility, leadership, and ethics have always been important to me, and I expect it to be important in elected officials, and the more powerful a person is, the more they should be without blame. I want to thank you all for your hard work for the people of Oregon, and I'm glad to see the legislature is finally working on something that will restrict some of these unfair practices.
Thank you. Questions for Mr. Baum or Mr. Reese? Looks like you're off the hook this morning. We really appreciate you guys joining us.
Thank you.
Anybody else wishing to testify this morning on Senate Bill 10 this morning? Okay. With that, we're going to close the public hearing, and we're hoping to move into work session next week on the bill. We wanted to give Legislative Council a little bit of breathing room. So, next
Madam Chair, are we still on this? Can I just make
sure? Sure. I mean, well, I'll open the public hearing again. But
okay, I didn't realize we were. My apologies.
That's okay.
I appreciate all these folks coming in and testifying and having really concerns. And if you really want to see the system in action, we're going to have a very, I think, significant vote tomorrow in Ways and Means on Senate Bill 426. Is it 426, 423? And, you know, if you really want to see the real action and get behind and figure out what's going on in this system, there's a lesson to be learned in the vote on 426 tomorrow on the Senate Bill in Ways and Means. And I would just invite you folks to come out and see how the system really works.
Thank you, Ms. Senator Nelson. With that, we're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 10 and open a public hearing. I'm going to move to Senate Bill 74. Yes. Senate Bill 74. Ms. Taylor, would you tell us a little bit about the bill? And we need a sign-up sheet.
Yes, absolutely. Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 74 modifies and repeals laws relating to elections conducted at polling places. And this comes to you from the Secretary of State's office.
All right, we've got Brenda Bays from the Secretary of State's office and Nicole Williams from the Oregon Association of County Clerks. We assume the two of you don't mind testifying with each other. Okay, great. Hi, and welcome.
Chair Brown and members of the Oregon Senate Rules Committee, my name is Nicole Williams. I'm the Clatsop County Clerk, and I'm also the Elections Legislative Chair for the Oregon Association of County Clerks, and I'm here to support Senate Bill 74 on behalf of the association today. In 1981, the Oregon Legislature approved a test of vote-by-mail for local elections. In 1987, vote-by-mail was made permanent, and the majority of the counties used it in local and special elections. In 1993, June of 93, the first special statewide election was conducted by mail. In 95, the second statewide special election was held by mail. And in 1998, Oregon voters approved by almost 70% to expand vote-by-mail to primary and general elections. This was brought to the ballot by the initiative process. Vote by mail has been used in Oregon for over 20 years, and the presidential elections of 2000 and 2004 were conducted successfully by mail. Oregon has become the national model that we are now seeing other states following. There is increasing popularity of voters within our state for vote by mail and the privacy, accuracy, ease, and security it provides. The references still contained in statutes to polling place elections are outdated and confusing. At the general election in 2006, an attorney in Klamath County questioned the county clerk regarding a specific statute. The clerk notified the attorney that the statute cited referred to polling place elections. This situation is happening in every county in Oregon, especially during the primary and general elections. Not only are these polling place references confusing to observers in our offices, but they are also confusing to voters and to new elections administrators. Some counties are still storing polling place equipment, signs, supply boxes, voting booths. This equipment is obsolete. Storage is costly, and the counties could use the money for programs that are being threatened by the lack of funding. The voters of Oregon have embraced vote by mail, and the county clerks feel it is time to recognize their opinion by removing the statutes to address polling place elections. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you. Why don't you go ahead, and then we'll go to questions.
Okay. Thank you. For the record, my name is Brenda Bays. I'm the Deputy Director for the State Elections Division. Senate Bill 74 requires all elections to be conducted by mail and repeals laws relating to elections conducted at a polling place. The purpose of this bill is to remove all references to polling place elections, such as punched ballot labels, ballot stubs, polling places or polls, and poll books, all language applicable only to polling places. The last polling place election held in Oregon was in the general election of November 1998. The substantive change to the law is in Section 1, amending ORS 254.465 to remove the option for county clerks and the Secretary of State to conduct elections other than the primary and general election by mail. The other amendments conform election statutes to make this change. In addition, the bill removes language that relates only to punch card ballots because counties no longer use punch cards. The move to all vote-by-mail elections and the Federal Help America Vote Act of 2002 have made punch card ballots obsolete and the reference to them unnecessary. Finally, Legislative Council has made corrections within the amended statutes to conform to legislative style. If the committee has any questions at this time, I'm more than happy to address them. Thank you.
There are no amendments, correct?
That's correct.
Okay. Questions for this panel? Senator Johnson?
First, to welcome a constituent to the Capitol and thank you for your testimony. And secondly, while I support the bill, I have to say that I do with a sad heart. There's something so special about going and standing in lines at a school or a parish hall or something, some gathering place with fellow citizens exercising our most important franchise as Americans. And I miss it terribly. I think it devalues our ballot to have it arrive with the Sears bill and the Chevron bill and the ads. And
no offense to Sears or Chevron, right?
Well, whatever. So while I understand you're cleaning up statutes, it pains me to thrust one more dagger into the heart of standing down at the parish hall.
I understand. Senator Farrielli. Speeches, Senator Farrielli.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just thinking of the guy that has to drive 2.5 hours north to French Glen to drive to Burns to get to the polling place. I was happy to support vote by mail, just because time and distance are issues for lots of Oregonians, and so this seems to me to be it may be a nostalgic moment, but we're in the 21st century now. So.
Some of us are coming kicking and screaming.
All right, I think you're off the hook in terms of questions. Do we have these two on another bill?
Brenda's here for 77.
Okay, we're going to split you up now. So. Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 74. I know Senator Anderson has a radio interview here shortly, and so hopefully you can make it back in order to help us vote these out. Let's move to Senate Bill 77. Thank you.
Okay.
And Ms. Taylor, why don't you tell us a little bit about this bill?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 77 makes miscellaneous changes to elections law. I'll let Brenda go into detail.
Okay. Thank you. Take it away.
Thank you, Chair. Chair Brown, members of the committee, again, for the record, my name is Brenda Bays. I'm the Deputy Director for the State Elections Division. Senate Bill 77 is the general housekeeping bill for the conduct of elections and encompasses 12 sections, so hopefully this should go fairly quickly for you. Section 1 is in regard to RS 236.320, which is the statute that sets forth how to submit someone from resigning from office. In that statute, it currently does not allow, it doesn't require that the person withdrawing from office would need to sign the document stating they're withdrawing from office or submit it in writing. We would like to add a subsection to that to provide that the individual resigning from office must submit so in writing, and this provides for that section. Section 2, RS 249-042, is in regard to someone filing a declaration or a petition filing for candidacy for a major political party. We would like to delete the requirement that the candidate who files for candidacy by petition must sign the prospective petition before submitting the petition for approval. What this means is that when they file for office, they file the candidacy form, and they indicate on that form that they are filing by filing fee or filing by a prospective petition, gathering signatures. When they file by prospective petition, they also submit the signature sheet that they will be circulating. The statute currently indicates that they need to sign the prospective petition, which means on the signature sheet on line one, they sign their name. We think that this is not needed, as they are filing the candidacy form at the same time with their signature, and there really is no reason that they should have to file the prospective petition line one at the same time. Section 3, RS 249-061, sets forth the process for filing for office by a nominating petition. And again, that same language is in that statute in which they would have to sign line one of the prospective petition. And we would like to delete that requirement from the statute. Section 4 is RS 249-064. It's information that is required on a nominating petition. We'd like to clarify that an elector signing a nominating petition for a major party candidate to include either their residence or mailing address of the elector. Current statute just requires that they have their residence address. A lot of electors include their mailing address instead, and we'd like to give them the authority to have either residence or mailing address when signing those petitions. Section 5, RS 249-078, is the same requirement on presidential candidates nominating petitions. We would like to give them that option of the elector signing and putting either their residence or mailing address. Section 6, RS 249-830.830, deletes the requirement that a candidate who has been nominated and files a statement of withdrawal from the nomination must be acknowledged by the candidate before a notary. We feel that this is unnecessary, that they have the form notarized. Just their signature should be sufficient. So we'd like to delete the requirement of it being in front of a notary public. It also clarifies that the withdrawal must be signed by the candidate and submitted no later than the 67th day before the general election. Section 7, ORS 249.865, is regarding recall petitions. Allows for the addition of the chief petitioner's name and address to be listed on the petition for recall form. Current statute states that the treasurer's name is on the recall form that is being circulated. We would like to also allow for the chief petitioner's name as well on that recall, because often they are not the same individual. This would give more information for the public when signing the recall petition. Section 8, ORS 250.355, is in regard to the date of an election for a city referendum. This is just a correction in reference to whether it's a measure or a petition when it's filed. When it's filed, it is a petition when they submit the signatures. It does not become a measure until it, of course, qualifies for the recall election. So this is just clarifying language. Section 9, ORS 253.030, is in regard to an elector requesting an absentee ballot if they will not be in the county at the time of the election. This would allow for an elector to request an absentee ballot for any election in a format designated by the Secretary of State or by electronic mail. They could do it by email. Currently, there's no provision to allow for that. Section 10, RS 260.2. 2.715 adds a provision that would prohibit an elector from voting in an election held in this state or in another state at the same on the same date. We had an incident in the last election in which someone voted in the same election that they voted in Oregon. They also voted in the same election in another state on the same day. We did take that to the Attorney General's office, but we were unable to go forward with it because we didn't have the authority for the other state to do anything. We would like to add the provision or in another state on the same election day.
Okay, now you have our attention. Senator Johnson.
I am actually thrilled to hear you report that, and my question is, how'd you catch it?
Yeah, that was my question, too. Chair
Brown, Senator Johnson.
Sorry.
It was in the Washington elections when
the recount of Christine Gregoire and
that's correct, and it was found at that time and forwarded to Oregon.
Thank you. You're welcome. Senator Farrioli.
Madam Chair, I think there's more than a vague suspicion that many of our out-of-state college students receive absentee ballots. They also, in their registration package, are encouraged to register in Oregon to vote. And it's long been suspected that they receive Oregon ballots and out-of-state ballots as well. And so I guess my question would be, why was it necessary in this change to add on the same date? Wouldn't we want to pursue, at least from a statutory perspective, a prohibition about voting in anybody's election? You know, whether that is held on the same date or not the same date, we don't want folks voting in Oregon and in another state at the same time or at any time. I guess wouldn't it be clearer if we asked for the prohibition, the statutory prohibition, to be against voting in an Oregon election and voting in another state also, or actually maintaining dual voter registrations? That's really what I think we're after. But I'd like to hear you talk about that. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Chair Brown, Senator Farrioli, that's a very good question. I'm sure that we're open to reviewing that suggestion with you. So I just would like to clarify that you're indicating the same election. So you're saying if the primary in a different state is on a different day,
exactly,
and the primary is here, they're both, and they participate in both primary elections.
Right.
That's a very good point, and I'm, you know, we're open to that suggestion.
Okay. Madam Chairman, we have Secretary of State's indicated that in the case of independence, an elector would be disqualified from nominating an independent if they'd voted either in the Republican primary or the Democrat primary. And I'm just thinking that along those same logical lines, that we really ought to be aiming at trying to prevent people from voting in multiple elections in multiple states.
That's probably appropriate, Senator Farrioli.
But I'd be satisfied
to
just
have you work with the Secretary of State's office
to
come up
Thank
with
you.
Some language. That'd be great.
Thanks.
Section 11 just simply provides effective dates for sections in the bill. Section 12 provides that the Act takes effect on its passage. If the committee has any additional questions, I'm more than happy to answer them.
Questions? Thank you. You obviously know the section that's most intriguing to us. So we'll let Senator Farrioli take his hand at coming up with some stuff on and some language. Obviously, I think it could get a little tricky, and I'm just thinking of Washington, where we have our primary in May, and they have their primary in September, and what happens if someone moves? You voted in here in May. Can you turn around and register there and vote for their primary in September? I suspect that doesn't happen a lot, but with students, it could very easily could. So want to make sure we don't, you know, get people into trouble unnecessarily.
Well,
so
maybe that means,
yeah,
that could be the explanation with on the same date.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. So So anyway, we'll let you guys take and see if we can get that provision worked out before we move forward on this bill.
And Madam Chairman, just for clarification's sake, is it currently illegal to vote in more than one state in Oregon?
Chair Brown, Senator Farioli, in the statute, it specifically says that you may not vote in the same election on the same election day.
Senator Johnson?
Let me just pursue that a little bit further. Take Senator Brown's example. I vote in Oregon, and then I move to Washington. That becomes my legal residence, and I try to vote in their primary because I'm now establishing myself as a legal resident of Washington. And that has nothing to do with the same date. Could I vote in both states?
Yep. Under current law, it sounds like it. We're getting lots of nods.
Chair Brown, Senator Johnson, let me just read what the statute does say.
Okay.
A person may not vote or attempt to vote more than once at any election held on the same date.
Well, and that's tricky with Oregon's vote by mail because our election date is really essentially 2.5 to 3 weeks long. So we may need to spend a little time on this. Senator Johnson?
I could, and I'm making this up on the fly, but could specifying the election date cause it to be the same day? So the fact that we have this several-week run-up to it, the election, if we defined it, would actually be on a date specific.
Mm-hmm. That's correct.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. All right. We'll let you guys spend some time exploring that issue. Anybody else wishing to testify on Senate Bill 77? Not seeing any volunteers. We're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 77 and open the public hearing on Senate Bill 124. Mr. Schrader, why don't you come forward? Ms. Taylor, why don't you tell us about the bill?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 124 allows the Attorney General to correct some clerical errors in a draft or certified ballot title that they prepare.
Thank you. Mr. Schrader, welcome. I'm going to say Schrader. Sorry, you knew what I was going to do, didn't you?
Chair sorry. Brown, members of the committee, Philip Schrader, special counsel to the Attorney General, not Senator Schrader. This bill is intended.
His name is always on our lips.
This bill is intended to help us do a better public service for the public. Under the current statutory regime, you're probably familiar, we issue a draft ballot title and a certified ballot title, which is subject to Supreme Court review if somebody challenges it. However, there's a bit of an anomaly in the current statutes, which is that either if nobody challenges our certified ballot title or nobody files comments on our draft ballot title, those ballot titles are by statute the ballot title that must be issued in the voter's pamphlet. We try and try as we might to avoid any errors in our ballot titles, but every once in a while an error will creep in. And the only way to have that corrected, and in fact there is no way to correct it unless somebody has participated in the process and is available to challenge it in the Supreme Court, the only way that we can get that corrected is if somebody is available to actually file the challenge in the Supreme Court. It's very cumbersome to have to utilize such a process if all we're attempting to need to correct something like a typographical error, either a misspelling, or if we said 10% rather than 1% when it was clear that 1% should have been in the ballot title as opposed to 10%. The statutory change is all in ORS Chapter 250, and the changes are really in Section 1 sub 2, and in B, it's if we have a draft ballot title that has not received any comments, and in sub C, if the certified ballot title has an error in it. We are hopeful that this would receive favorable treatment by the committee. It's really intended to be a cost savings mechanism and a public service so that if we do make a mistake, it can be corrected and we don't have to be in the unfortunate or unhappy circumstance of having an error in a ballot title that goes into the voter's pamphlet. I'd be happy to answer any questions the committee might have.
Thank you. Mr. Schrader, I guess my question is, how do you go about determining it's a clerical error, and how do the parties get involved so that
if there's some redress, for example, you think it's a clerical error and they don't, where do you go from there?
So. Yes, Chair Brown, very, very good question, because we struggled with how do we characterize it and how do we, the intent here is simply to be, if it truly is a clerical typographical type error, beauty is in the eye of the beholder, and I'm sure there could be some issues about whether it is or isn't. If somebody is involved in the process and is interested in seeking Supreme Court review, they would seek Supreme Court review of the corrected ballot title and would have every opportunity to challenge that and argue that it wasn't a clerical or typographical error. The more difficult circumstance, I suppose, is when there hasn't been anybody involved in the process that has either filed comments on the draft or challenged the certified ballot title or is able to challenge the certified ballot title. If there would be more narrow parameters around that that the committee would like to consider, we'd be open to discussing that. The best terminology we could come up with was what we put into the statute with Elsie's help.
Okay, thank you. Questions? Senator Farrioli.
Are there statutory definitions for clerical and typographical errors?
Chair Brown, Senator Farrioli, not to my knowledge.
Well, I just saved our committee staff, Marjorie Taylor, an hour of research. Scurry off and find those definitions. You know, I think that I'm glad you pointed out that it's in the eye of the beholder. If it's a decimal place, but the substance doesn't change except for the, you know, the order of magnitude, I think people would agree that's a typographical. Could you, in fact, substitute a whole word, for instance?
Chair Brown, Senator Farrioli. One example that comes to mind, I believe that in a draft ballot title, we had issued something that said public official something something. And when it moved to the certified ballot title, it turned into public office, and it was simply a clerical error that a word processor, that a word processing program didn't pick up because spelled correctly. So the intent here would be that yes, in circumstances like that, a different word would be substituted. Now, again, I mean, we're here only to try and help the situation here. This is not intended to, you know, provide carte blanche to the Attorney General's office to make substantive changes. That's not what we're intending to do, and nor do we want to do that. And if there's concern about the terminology that we have in the current draft, we'd be happy to work with that. The goal behind the draft language is, if it is clear that it's a clerical typographical type error, that we would be allowed to correct it.
Madam Chair, I think what Mr. Schradl described was a Scribner's error, not a typographical or a clerical error. In other words, in transcription, the meaning was changed. That's neither a typographical error nor a punctuation type error. You could argue that it was or was not a clerical error. But, Madam Chair, I think if those definitions don't exist in statute, then the camel moves through the eye of the needle.
Chair Brown, Senator Farrioli, our intent using the term clerical was to accomplish that piece of it, and Scrivener's error would also work. The terminology, I mean, we are open to discussion about that, because the goal here is not to, like I say, give our office carte blanche to make substantive changes, and that's not the goal. And we're just attempting to try and help out so that if we do make what is an error, that we can correct it without either having to call upon the parties to engage the court system in the process,
right.
Or there may be circumstances where there aren't any parties that can engage the process, and we are stuck with having an erroneous ballot title.
Madam Chair, one more.
Senator Farrioli.
Thank you. Would it be fair to characterize these as restorations of the original text?
Chair Brown, Senator Farrioli, unfortunately, I think not. There are times when comments come in that then we are responding to. So we are intending to change from the draft to the certified ballot title. And so it might not have been language that was in the draft ballot title, but an error is in the certified ballot title. For example, we may have had 10%. 10% might be a bad example. But in the example I was giving you, when we changed the terminology going from public official something something to public office, we didn't necessarily need to go back to the draft ballot title language exactly per se. So I'm not sure that just going back to because we may not have had the terminology that's incorrect in the draft ballot title.
Madam Chair, I can see the corrective benefit, and I can see certainly correcting punctuation or misspellings or even decimal places. And beyond that, I think you start getting into a place where people might be a little nervous.
Thank you, Senator Farrelly. Thank you. Any other questions for Mr. Schradl? We appreciate you joining us.
Certainly. Thank you.
Anybody else wanting to touch base or testify on Senate Bill 124? All right. With that, seeing no takers at this point in time, we're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 124. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 422. Ms. Taylor, why don't you tell us about it? Somebody needs to. We know Senator Walker's outside the door. Somebody could just scream for her. That would be great. Nicole Williams, I don't know if you want to come up again. That'd be great. Go ahead.
Chair Brown, members of the committee, Senate Bill 422 directs the county clerk to have personnel available on Saturdays and Sundays before primary and general elections to provide information to candidates about electors who have cast ballots in those elections. And this comes to you from Senator Walker.
Thank you. Who is, come on in. We'll bring her on up. Good morning, Senator Walker.
Good morning.
How are you?
Hi, can you hear me
though? Yes.
Okay.
And sitting next to you is Nicole Williams. She's from Clatsop County, Senator Johnson territory.
Okay, nice to meet you.
Go ahead.
Vicki Walker, State Senator, District 7. I think their election officials are all a-Twitter about this bill. So I like to introduce bills that start a conversation. This conversation needs to be had because we have problems during our elections. You know, we have a vote-by-mail system, which is really great, but we have a lot of people who vote on the weekends. And this last election, in fact, there were boxes. We have boxes around our community in Lane County that people stuff their ballots into, and the boxes were overflowing, and the ballots were coming out of the boxes. We had to have someone contact one of our Lane County commissioners to try to get someone to go down and take care of those overflowing boxes. In the meantime, we had someone stationed there to make sure those boxes weren't going to have anyone pilfering ballots out of them. But the other issue is people in Oregon have grown to absolutely hate phone calls during an election. They hate being called to be reminded to vote, but it's all part of the process. It's part of the election process. My goal is to get elected, just like that's your goal. So we do what we can to get elected, and getting elected requires us finding out who's voted and calling them if they haven't turned in their ballot. Well, it'd be nice to know if they have turned in their ballot. We run elections differently. We used to just vote one day. And I remember those days going out at 4:30 in the morning. They'd pair me up with a big guy, and we'd go out at 4:30 in the morning and hang door hangers on people's doors. And then all day long we'd be going to the polling booth and marking off and taking out of our little Rolodex thing all the people who'd voted. And if you hadn't voted, we'd call you. Well, today this election cycle is three weeks long, and everybody seems to want to wait till the last weekend before the election, which doesn't help the people who are trying to get elected track and monitor who's voted, who hasn't. And so then we call and they say, I've already voted. And we say, well, we're not showing that you voted because county election officials haven't worked over the weekend to process the ballots. I understand you'd have to pay your staff extra. That could be negotiated in your requirements. I have a letter from Ted Rettlinger from Legislative Council when he gave me back my bill draft and said that this bill does not require county election clerk's office to employ personnel for any particular hours. So we could modify the bill to make sure that there were certain hours on the weekend, that maybe 4 hours on a weekend, on a Saturday and a Sunday. There's nothing in state or federal law that prohibits requiring election personnel to work any particular day or 7 days a week. So they're not required to, and they're not prohibited from doing that. If they're part of a labor union, of course they have contracts that they negotiate, that could be done. But you know, for me, it's just about making sure your vote gets counted, and that we preserve the integrity of an election, and that we stop these harassing phone calls to people. They consider them harassing. We consider them good government. But if they voted, I want to know it, and we can take them off the list and stop harassing people. So that's really what this is all about. It's, you know, coming from just out of fresh out of another election that required us to do a lot of phone calling. It brought that issue to bear, and people are frustrated with those robocalls, and I understand there's some senator here that may be introducing a bill to ban robocalls. I think that's going a bit too far. I don't know how you can prevent that, but at least we can keep the ballot boxes empty, and we can process these ballots a little more quickly. So that's what I'm here for.
Thank you, Senator Walker. Questions? Senator Johnson?
Thank you very much for the presentation. Where do you anticipate the money to pay the additional elections personnel is going to come from?
Well, I thought you'd ask that question, Madam Chair and Senator Johnson, because that seems like a reasonable thing to ask, and it would come out of the general fund, which is why this bill probably has no chance, no prayer, no hope of ever passing.
Out of state general fund?
Sure.
Not county general
fund? Well, it would be, because we can't pass an unfunded mandate on counties. We have a bill that became a statute that said we can't do that. So we'd have to provide the extra staffing. And I would, you know, you could also limit it to counties that have a large percentage of voters. I mean, some counties have a small number of voters where this isn't an issue. But the larger counties do. Jackson, Lane, Multnomah, Marion.
Follow-up, Madam Chair.
Senator Johnson.
Have you done any rough calculation on what you think the fiscal is?
No, I have not, and I didn't get a fiscal before, Madam Chair, Senator Johnson, I didn't get a fiscal for this bill before it was presented.
Yes.
Any other questions for Senator Walker? Thank you very much. We appreciate you joining us. You're welcome to stick around. But
yeah, I'll sit around and take some notes.
Okay.
I'm good at that. Thank
Ms.
you.
Ms. Williams, welcome again.
Thank you. Chair Brown and members of the Oregon Senate Rules Committee, my name is Nicole Williams. I'm the Clatsop County Clerk, but today I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Association of County Clerks, and I am testifying in opposition of Senate Bill 422. The intent of this bill is for county elections offices to be open Saturday and Sunday preceding the primary and general election. I believe the primary purpose is to provide an updated voter list to candidates and members of the public, so it's open to whomever requests these lists. However, the way the bill has been drafted, I don't think it will accomplish this purpose, because these voter lists will probably not change from that you could have obtained on Friday afternoon. This is because ballots received would not necessarily be entered into our election systems that Saturday and Sunday, and therefore the list would be the same, as I said before. Also, many Oregon counties, especially the larger counties, are already working on Saturday and Sunday preceding the election. And we're doing this because we need to catch up. We're in a very busy time. We use Saturday and Sundays, if they're not already open to the public, to catch up on our many other election duties. If we are required to use this time to serve candidates and members of the public, we could be in a situation where our offices become further behind, which, unless we would hire more help, and the result would be an even more outdated voter list and more delayed election results on election night, or greater cost of elections to the taxpayers. By requiring all 36 counties to remain open to serve candidates and the public over the specified weekend, you've already heard that the fiscal impact would be significant. We would have to staff our offices to accommodate the candidates and the public. I'm not sure how we would open our doors to serve the candidates and members of the public requesting voter lists, but close our doors to voters that would want to come in and get a replacement ballot. Additionally, what makes sense for some larger counties does not make sense for smaller counties. Many smaller counties, for example, Lake County with 4,400 voters, or even my county, Clatsop County, with 22,000 voters. I don't believe we would have very many requests, if any, for voter lists on the weekend. We would like to suggest
that most of these requests for information be arranged prior to the weekend. If the county is working over the weekend, as I believe many of the larger counties are, the information could be emailed to the candidate each day, as it is often done on a daily basis now during the week. This procedure could get the needed information timely to the candidates where the need exists and not require the extra expense to all Oregon counties. Thank you for your time, and I would be open to answer any questions you may have.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you. I think Senator Walker raised two issues, at least I heard two issues. One of them was the integrity of the process, and the second one was the expenditure of public money providing services to candidates. I am very worried about the first one that she raised, and I would welcome your comments on what your association is doing to address the question of ballot collection vessels overflowing or being unattended or not being monitored in a way that preserves the integrity of the ballots.
Chair Brown, Senator Johnson. The current bill, obviously, it does not address the collection of the ballots, and I think you know that. However, you know, we recognize that is an issue in some of the larger counties. And currently, we don't have a provision in law that I believe that we requires us to when that we have to collect those ballots from ballot drop boxes. But it is something we can address as an association.
And Senator Johnson, I think we wrestled with that issue last session in this committee, and I can't remember if we couldn't come up with a solution.
Chair Brown, it's hard because we're all different sizes.
Mm-hmm.
So we have different needs. And
we maybe did try and wrestle with this issue and couldn't come to resolution, Senator Johnson.
I would just make the concluding comment that I think there's a little bit of voter responsibility here. I treat my ballot as a very treasured piece of paper. I wouldn't leave my home mortgage payment laying on the curb hoping that somebody would come and pick it up. I would hope that voters would have the modicum of intelligence to say, if I can't secure my ballot in a vessel, I'm not going to just put it here on the sidewalk and hope for the best.
You don't have to respond to that if you don't want
to. Chair Brown, Senator Johnson, I wish that every voter treated their ballot like you did.
All right. Any other questions for Ms. Williams, or should we let her off the hook this afternoon, this morning? Okay. Anybody else wishing to testify on Senate Bill 422? Come on up. Mr. Buchanan?
Good morning.
Welcome.
I'm David Buchanan. I'm the state chair for Oregon Common Cause. Common Cause has long observed and participated in election reform in this state. One specific item that I'd like to suggest to you is that there is a technological change on the horizon that will alter this particular problem. In some other states, in California, in San Mateo County, they acknowledge receipt of a ballot online, so that a person can go online and see that their ballot has been received by their county clerk. This kind of a situation could happen in Oregon fairly soon, because currently when ballots arrive, as the phrase has it, they are wanded, their barcode is scanned,
mm-hmm.
and then that ballot's receipt is acknowledged into the computer system that tracks ballots. So it's a technological step. But at some point, it's something that the counties in Oregon will look at and will probably enact as a convenience to the voter, because the first level of this is voter's convenience and to allow a voter to know that their ballot has been received. So at some point, this kind of issue will be solved more than a phone call to the clerk's office, did my ballot arrive, to simply going online and seeing, okay, there's the acknowledgement that ballot has been received.
Thank you, Mr. Buchanan. That's really cool. That's great to know. My only caution is I know, at least in my county, Multnomah County, they work really hard to check signatures and make sure that there's no voter fraud going on. So I hope that moving to technology doesn't prohibit that sort of step. Any comments? We appreciate that information.
Thank you very much.
I'm sure it'll cost us a lot of money, and we'll do it in the future, but it sounds great. Senator Walker, you wish to add anything at this point?
Catch up on some things in the meantime. And there was just a comment that was made, Vicki Walker, state senator again, that I just found a little incredulous, that there wasn't, what are we going to do about the ballot collection vessels? That was the question Senator Johnson asked. And she says, there's no provision in the bill to do that. Well, we can certainly do that, but that they'll look at it. Well, you know, you may have addressed it last session. You attempted to address it, Madam Chair, but it's still a problem. Whether people are deliberately putting their ballot in a box when it's full and overflowing, I can't help that they do that, but it's incumbent upon us to preserve the integrity of the darn election. So there should be some staff that goes out and regularly checks those ballot boxes. I mean, that's not that difficult of a task.
Thank you. I know we had a hearing on this issue. I'll try and take a look at what we did last session. So,
well, you can certainly use my bill probably as a vehicle to make that change, because it doesn't look to me like I'm going to get what I need, though, as my suggestion was that we limit it to just some of the larger counties. And if some of the larger counties are already working, I don't see that this creates that much of a fiscal, but I could be wrong.
Thank you, Senator Walker. Anybody else? We're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 422. We have a number of committee measures for introduction, seeing that it's our last meeting day before the drop-dead deadline on Monday. For folks who are interested, there are a number of committees open on Monday afternoon for bill introduction. I've just decided, since there are a number of other committees open on Monday afternoon, that we don't need to be open solely for the purpose of committee measure introduction. So we will not be meeting on Monday, but Senate Judiciary meets at 1. And, Marjorie, there's another meeting at 3 o'clock.
Commerce
at 3 o'clock. So just be aware to folks out there that there are committee. And you're meeting on Monday morning, correct, Lori?
Yes.
Senator Monis Anderson, sorry.
And Human Services, Madam Chair, is at 3 o'clock.
3 o'clock. Okay. So we should be in good shape. And on the bills that were in front of us this morning, let's spend a little time taking a look at these and see if we can't get some changes made that will make folks happy. And with that, I'm going to open a work session for the purposes of introducing some committee measures. I believe that committee staff have sent you all the drafts. I frankly, to be honest with you, I don't know who deposited these with my office. We've just had a fairly blanket policy. So we are asking for your vote today that they be introduced as committee bills and not for the purposes of objection or support of a particular measure. So, Senator Johnson?
Madam Chair, with that caveat, I would are you looking for a motion?
Sure.
I would move the introduction of LC-1970, LC-2516, LC-2677, LC-2711, and LC-2879, LC-3675, and that's it.
Thank you. Senator Johnson has moved the introductions of LCs 1970, 2516, 2711, 2677, 2879, and 3675 be introduced as committee bills. Any discussion? Any objection?
So long, Madam Chairman, this is for the purpose of introduction.
That is correct. Purpose of introduction, I'm seeing no objection. It's so ordered. Okay. Let's go into, do we have a work session scheduled on Senate Bill 10? Oh, we do. Good. Okay. We just have a public hearing on Senate Bill 10. I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 10. Senator Farrell, you wanted to make some comments.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The -9 amendments to Senate Bill 10 are available. And that is essentially restores the gift limitations to the current $100 level. And, Madam Chair, I just want to make really clear that it's my strong opinion that it isn't the amount of gift or the level that's a problem. It's the reporting issue. And I think Senate Bill 10 has what we need to do is focus on the reporting question and make sure that gets resolved for people. Let me just point out that currently in the House we have a gift limitation of $0 or $10, and that puts us in a situation where a number of members have had to go to the House Secretary to get what is essentially an arbitration on whether or not they can attend events and whether or not the attendance of an event has to trigger within the individual member dietary restrictions. I mean, they've actually been told, go to a reception, but don't eat more than $10 worth of hors d'oeuvres. I mean, the idea is that you can quickly enter the realm of ridiculousness with the limitations and all the things that are driven by that, when actually what we're trying to get to is full disclosure. So, Madam Chairman, I will propose that the Senate Bill 10, Amendment -9, just restore the current gift level to $100 that's already in statute, and that we focus our efforts instead on disclosure. Madam Chairman, I also have Senate Bill 10-10 amendments, and that has to do with the revolving door issue. And the revolving door issue that I would like to focus on is that what we need to do is stop the revolving door from revolving in multiple directions. So this -10 amendment would also stop legislators from moving into high-paying jobs in state agencies, as well as moving into lobbying jobs. And it would also ban special interest from moving into positions in the executive branch, so that if you are a GSPC-registered lobbyist, you would not be able then to move directly into a administration role in a state agency as a director or otherwise. So I guess what I'm trying to do is say, look, if the revolving door from legislator to lobbyist needs to be stopped, so does the revolving door from lobbyist to administrator or legislator to administrator. So I would offer those two amendments.
And I assume, Senator Farrelly, on Senate and the -10 amendments, there's an exception for people who get elected to office. It just, you can't get appointed in the executive branch, but you can get elected.
Madam Chairman, I think it was never our intention to prohibit an elector,
okay,
an elector from an elected from assuming the office to which they've been elected.
So, could you talk to me about the distinction in your mind of why it's not okay for someone to take an appointment in the executive branch, but it's okay for them to get elected to the executive branch?
Sure, Madam Chairman. The we have a current prohibition, I think, against let me come at it to answer your question. It seems to me to be patently a conflict if an individual votes on an agency budget to increase the agency budget and then takes office as the agency director. It seems to me to be a direct conflict in that case. It also seems to be, in my opinion, a conflict if on a controversial vote, folks who might face a very difficult re-election campaign are offered sort of a golden parachute and then end up in, you know, in state agency offices as executive directors, possibly driven by political considerations. I'm not trying to prevent people from gainful employment. I just believe if you've got a situation that appears to be an ethical question, folks moving between agencies or among roles that we play in this legislative process, that's the definition of the revolving door. And it does revolve more than one way. I mean, people always want to focus on legislators moving to lobbyists. Frankly, I think that's probably the most innocuous change. The other ones seem to me to be far more conflicted.
Thank you.
That's why I'm offering the amendment.
All right. Sarah Johnson?
Well, I'm not unsympathetic to some of the issues that my learned colleague raises. I think that perhaps some additional amplification or at least understanding would be helpful. How about an agency head who is terminated from one agency or is no longer a good fit for one agency but is an excellent fit for another? your amendment would prohibit that?
No, ma'am. The lateral movement between agencies isn't addressed in this issue.
And how do you consider lateral? The pay grade?
If you're registered as a lobbyist, as a state agency head, you could not move from one agency head to another under this.
Well, I raised that question. I also raised the question, appointments to remunerative boards or commissions.
Could you amplify or clarify your question?
A legislator being appointed to, I'm just taking my predecessor to the Northwest Power Planning Council.
Okay, and?
And I'm trying to ascertain, because I haven't had the opportunity to read your amendments, would that prohibit that?
It would, Madam Chair. Okay.
All right. Senator Nelson?
Go ahead. I just wanted to follow up a little bit more. That was my question, too, regarding the variety of commissions, Commission on Children and Families, et cetera, that would prohibit a legislator from being appointed to those.
Madam Chairman, I think if they were, if that were a paid position.
So yes. Strictly paid.
Yes, ma'am.
Think so. We'd have to look at the statute on that one under this. Yeah. Sarah Nelson?
If you're still on the decision, I have a different issue.
Okay.
So, Madam Chairman, the two amendments are
okay.
Open invitation for members to help me craft what I think are reasonable changes, particularly on the Dash 10 amendments. I'd like to engage folks in a discussion of what the definition of the revolving door really is. And I'm certainly open to having changes suggested by members. I think if we focus on one element, which is legislators who become lobbyists, there really are other elements of the revolving door that we could profitably look at.
Okay.
Thank you.
Senator Johnson?
Madam Chair, respectfully, I'm having a really hard time seeing this whole ethics tableau in any kind of context, having labored in the vineyards all interim long on law commission work and sitting through interminable meetings. I'm trying to figure out, where's the reconciliation point? If it's the chair's intent to have Senate Bill 10 move as the ethics vehicle, that's one thing. But there was a lot of good stuff that came up in the context of the law commission discussions. And at this point, it seems sort of dispersed widely. And I don't know if there's going to be an intention to bring everything back together again. I have a hard time doing one-off amendments to one bill when I know that out there are numerous really thoughtful recommendations from the Law Commission that touch on a lot of issues that transcend transparency and gift reporting. I still am very perplexed by some of the outcomes of the conversation that we had in the context of the Law Commission work about the use of campaign finances and how clear or unclear that is. A lobbyist can't take me to Hawaii but can give me campaign money and I buy my own trip. I'm still trying to reconcile all of those pieces. And I'm just looking for clarity in where does all of this stuff converge?
Thank you, Senator Johnson. I appreciate that. Senate Bill 10, as you guys all recall, deals with the five different issues. Increased online reporting, dedicated funding for the GSPC, increase in fines from $1,000 to $5,000, including a letter of reprimand, however you want to call it, the revolving door and the gift ban. It also includes the Law Commission's piece on the Legal Defense Trust Fund. And we plan to move that bill out of this committee next week. I believe, and I haven't been able to change this, that it has a Ways and Means referral. On February 28th, we will have a joint committee hearing with the House Rules Committee on the remainder of the Law Commission bills, which will have some of those are duplicative. There's no question about that. But the Law Commission, it will be presenting to us their entire, all of their bills. Senator Rosenbaum and I have met and essentially split up those bills. We will begin to work some, and the House will begin to work some. So we will move from that standpoint. But Chair still intends to move Senate Bill 10 and address those five issues head on.
And that's fair. I'm just trying to understand in receiving sort of one-off amendments how it fits into the whole lay of the land of campaign campaign fund applications and the stuff that we've been dealing with in the context of TAND.
And I think and Senator Farrelly's been fairly cooperative about holding off his amendments on some of the issues that we'll deal with in the law commission bills. I know that Senator George recently introduced a bill dealing with conflict of interest. We will address that issue under the auspices of the law commission bills. The campaign finance issue is a little tricky in that I believe we've got both state and federal constitutional issues with where you can go to collect campaign checks. Happy to wrestle with that issue. I believe there's a law commission bill prohibiting the strict use of campaign dollars. My recollection is that is in the House committee and may or may not move from there depending upon where they go with it. You should also know that Senator Monroe is tackling that issue in the law, in the legislative operations. I was going to call it P-Call. I'm sorry, Marjorie. So we are wrestling with that issue. I do think we've got some constitutional issues with, you know, telling people where they can go and not go to accept campaign contributions. So
where they can go and not go to accept campaign contributions is not my issue. It's where they can go and not go using those campaign contributions that's my issue.
Well, they're certainly being tackled in a number of places, Senator. So
yes, kind of along those lines, it seems like we're making this thing so complicated that we're going to have 200 pages now of things to read through. My sense of this is that we need to have this complete transparency. The reporting is out there. We have to connect all of the various segments, whether it's campaign or whether it's ethics, for audit purposes so that the standard practices guys can look at it and audit it. We've got a $71 gift limit someplace. We've got a $100 gift or some sort of limit in another place. And then there's another $146 thing over in another section. What I think we need is we have to have a uniform figure.
That's why we chose $50, Senator Nelson.
Yeah, but, I mean, that's not where we're coming from auditing the whole thing. That's not how I'm hearing from the standard practices guys, is that that's not getting us there. Because aren't we separating two different things here, campaign finance reform and what you do as a public official?
Thank you, Senator Nelson. Yeah. Senator Johnson.
I don't know how you can not deal with both of them. I want to know whether or not I should be afraid to use campaign money to sleep all night in Tillamook. I mean, I want it that simple, and I don't want to find out after the fact. I think in many cases, very, very detailed reporting would help solve some of these problems and let the voters decide whether or not it's appropriate uses of campaign funds. But I think to have a conversation about ethics and neglect the conversation about the application of campaign funds is not achieving what Oregonians really want us to do.
Thank you, Senator Johnson. But I do think we're dealing with the issue of campaign dollars in the Senate Bill 10. It limits the use of campaign dollars to pay for ethics violations. So we tackled that issue head on. In terms of other restrictions on campaign issues, if folks want to put together a work group and tackle that issue, that's great. As I said, Senator Monroe is dealing with that issue in his committee. Representative Rosenbaum is dealing with that issue in her committee. If folks want to invite the Secretary of State's office and deal with the issue of double dipping, and I'm happy to bring that in front of this committee. I think that's a wholly different issue than what you can use and not use with your campaign dollars. But if folks want this committee to deal with that as well, I'm happy to do that. I'm letting the other committees tackle those issues because that's what we agreed to do. So
you answered my principal concern, and that was at some point all of this comes together so that it can be that all of the reform bills can be discussed in some broad context, and we can see what all is where, and that's my real interest.
And Senator Nelson, I don't know how to get to your concerns. I mean, we worked very hard to craft a proposal that was very clear, very straightforward, and very simple. That was the $50. We can't control the House rules. I appreciate that. If folks think that the $50 limit is inappropriate, you can certainly
add amendments, and Senator Farioli will certainly have the opportunity to discuss his amendment. In terms of disclosure, this committee already talked about the fact that having to disclose the $15 to $50 would get to be a disclosing nightmare. So we are not, the latest amendment regarding disclosure is that you will not have to disclose gifts from lobbyists between $15 and $50, but when you go over the $50 standard in one of the exemptions, you will need to disclose that. So I don't know how to get it any more simple than that, other than having a clear out ban of everything and let folks deal with it depending upon whether they have their own personal resources to deal with it or not. So, Senator Johnson.
One other issue that I just happened this morning that I just want to anecdotally add to this discussion. I was in the process of scheduling an appointment last week, and somebody on the other end of the phone snapped at me, and I snapped back. Today, unsolicited, arrives a bouquet of flowers. I don't know who this person is that sent me the flowers. I don't know the florist. Other than throwing them out in the hall, I don't know how much they cost. I don't know what to do with them, and there they are. And so I'm simply suggesting that while this is almost pressing the absurd, when we get down to the zero gift ban, the gift has been given. I put the flowers out in the hall so that I don't have anything to do with them. The gift has still been given. And I just offered that just because I think people sometimes think this is a lot easier than it is. And so I'm going to go upstairs and admire my ill-gotten gain in my office. I don't know how else to get rid of it.
Well, Senator Johnson, I can probably tell you, and I'm happy to do that off the record, where the flowers are from, since I just recently learned that myself. I do not recall if the flower, under our new proposal, Senate Bill Dunn, I believe if the flowers were under $50, they would be allowed. So I think you're off the hook on this one. If you were in the House, however, I do think they would be prohibited, but you would have to go to the committee to find out. Senator Farioli.
Committee of One, Madam Chair. It's
the Senator House. Farioli.
Yes, Madam Chair. In my office, as, yes. as I believe in everybody's office, A child safety chair showed up. Did everybody get one? And the instructions were to find some worthy person somewhere in our acquaintance that needed a child safety care, a kid carrier, a car seat. And I don't know whether that's a pass-through, whether that's a gift, whether that's a reportable, whether that's... It's certainly worth more than $50.
Thank you, Senator Farioli. I think you raise a really good point. Under the House rules, I believe that gift would be exempted because everyone got one. Under Senate Bill 10, you could not accept the gift, but I do think it would be appropriate to donate to someone, and I think that was the expectation as they donated the gift that you donate those on. So if you need help finding...
Well, we did precisely what Senator Johnson did. We put the thing out the door and hope it ends up in an appropriate venue.
Well, I think Senator Winters was actually gathering them to go to the Salem Relief Nursery. So if folks don't have a home for their chairs, let us know. At some level, folks, this is all about maintaining our ethical standards. And if folks are taking, Senator Johnson...
The only point that I raise this, and I think that this conversation has gone to this level of almost absurdity, is the fact that I just want to get on the record that it looks easier than it is in order to try to play within the rules. And I just think that shouldn't get lost in some of the very aggressive, robust reporting about this. It makes us all look as though we're down here with our hand out for something. And the fact is that things mysteriously appear. You can't track them backwards. You got to go find some charity to give them to. It just isn't as easy as it looks.
And I, Senator Johnson, of all people, I really appreciate that because we've certainly been tearing our hair out to get something that's simple and straightforward, and all of the public officials in Oregon, which are at 157,000, if you don't include volunteers, are close to 200,000. So we want to make sure that people can get their T-shirts, their apple pies, their occasional flowers. We don't want to take this to the level of absurdity. But at the same token, we also want to make sure that public officials are not accepting gifts that other folks don't get in the regular course of their business. So, all right. Thank you for that very interesting discussion. Anything else to come before the committee? No, not today. Okay. I need food. On that happy note, we're going to adjourn.